This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. Democratic candidate Joe Biden vows to be a president for all Americans as he's projected winner of the presidential election. Meanwhile, the U.S. president's campaign says it has filed a lawsuit in Arizona alleging a state's Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by some voters on Election Day. And people take to the streets in Pakistan's Karachi to denounce the French president's approval of blasphemous cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in at World News. Our top story, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in office. Several U.S. news outlets, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden extended his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His electoral vote count now stands at 290, surpassing the 270 needed to enter the White House. In a tweet, Biden said he promised to be a president for all Americans. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House and several other cities across the country to celebrate the win. Trump, however, has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the result in the courts. He's challenged results in several states already. In a statement, Trump said that Biden is rushing falsely to pose as winner of this election, as it is far from over. Trump's latest lawsuit was filed in Arizona, where he alleges that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. And reactions are pouring in following U.S. Network's projections that Joe Biden has been elected the 46th president of the United States. Campaign of U.S. incumbent President Donald Trump said it's not taking this development too well. Trump's advisor Rudy Giuliani repeated voter fraud allegations soon after the race was called for Biden. Giuliani said the networks do not get to decide elections, the courts do. Meanwhile, a number of prominent figures from the Democratic Party, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and former President Barack Obama, have hailed Biden's victory. Leaders of several other countries also congratulated Biden on his election win. Joining us now for extended conversation on this exact topic is Rami Mazahiri from Chicago and Ryan Downing, national security analyst, joining us from Florida. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. And Rami, I guess we'll start there in Chicago with you to get the latest. Go ahead, bud. Okay, it seems like we're having issues getting Rami. We don't have him on just yet. So I guess we will go to Florida. We're joined by Mr. Brian Downing. Hello, Brian. Your initial thoughts on this? I shouldn't say this declared by the media outlets a Joe Biden victor of the U.S. presidential race. Go ahead, bud.
Well, the media outlets are looking at the statistics. They're looking at the votes. They're looking at what's coming in from distant counties and districts, and they're making very cautious predictions. They're not going out on a limb by any means. It's almost certain that Biden will win this election. It will be verified in a few days. It will be verified by the Electoral College meeting, but this is done. And the president's claims of massive fraud are unsubstantiated. There's no evidence of it. He can demand recounts to some extent. I think he'll probably get one in Georgia. But it's happened. Biden has won this election.
Brian, why is Senator Lindsey Graham on board with Donald Trump, saying that he's going to help the Trump administration within the next 48 hours provide proof, evidence that there has been wide-scale fraud?
Well, Lindsey Graham has said some remarkable things in support of the president in the past. He's also expressed some criticisms, but he's never held on to those. He's a politician, not a very principled one. And even though he's just won a pretty big election in South Carolina, he does have to worry about the populist base. Trump has lost, but Trumpism is still out there. Lindsey Graham knows that.
Good point. And so do 7 million other Americans. We're swinging over to our correspondent out of Chicago, Rami Mazahari. Rami, seems like we have you on now. And now, Rami, tell us why exactly to Brian's point, you know, there is a huge electorate there that supports Donald Trump. What is it about Donald Trump and his message that resonates with nearly half of these basically record voters out there in the states? Nearly 150 million people voted, nearly half of them, for Donald Trump. Why?
Well, that's the question that they were unable to answer in 2016, and which we can answer with much more clarity now. But to go back to the previous analyst, maybe Joe Biden has won this election. We don't know. And that's really, you know, I think that us as foreign media and as objective journalists, we have to say that we don't know. The Associated Press is not qualified to decide who is the president. This has to be certified by board of electors, which is different in all 50 states. And then if there's a legitimate concern, it has to be decided by the courts. So certainly, I think we have to just say that it's not all over just because Associated Press says so, and the New York Times says so, and CNN says so. They haven't been elected by anybody. They haven't been verified by anybody at all. So to go back to your point, what's the appeal? Why did 70 million people vote for Donald Trump? If you're going to listen to these Biden supporters who are here right outside Trump Tower, if you can see it, they're going to give the idea that it's white supremacism. It's really preposterous. This is not the 1920s. This is not the 1880s. The KKK does not dominate like they used to. White supremacism is a real problem and a structural problem. But, we know now, this week, it's been proven that it's not a white supremacist movement, because then how do we explain how Trump increased his vote with black males, black females, Latino males, Latino females? Are they all white supremacists too? No, this was always a very, very lazy argument that we saw the same thing in France with the yellow vest, that we're going to demonize the white lower classes, and we're going to try and discredit their point of view by calling them anti-Semitic and racist. And it's absolutely not democratic. It's absolutely not intellectual. It's absolutely not useful. And now that we know that, if Trump loses, this is not a stinging rebuke of him. He's going to win 48-49% of the vote. That's a tremendous amount. And we know also that the blue wave has totally been defeated, and that Trumpian Republicans, they're now the ones who are elected. So this is a genuine movement. They might lose their figurehead, but what they said in 2016, that he's a tool of Russia, he's a Manchurian candidate, that all Trump supporters are white supremacists, that they're all uneducated, that they don't have a college degree, and that must make them horrible people who shouldn't have a say in democracy. All of these things are hysterical and preposterous. And to finally answer your question, the appeal is that he's not a politician, that he is an outsider, that he sees corruption among both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats. And what the Republican supporter believes is that this is not just the greatest country in the world, it's the greatest country in the history of mankind. That arrogance that Jefferson, Hamilton, Washington, they created this perfect system. This is what Republicans believe, and the problem is not the system itself and how antiquated and 18th century it is, but the people running it. So Republicans believe if you just change the people, get some better class of people in there morally, not in terms of technocracy or in terms of getting the most successful CEOs. If you get people who are moral and who are truly patriotic and not so globalist and don't want to send Americans off to die from wars that don't really affect the average person, then the system can be saved. So that's the appeal, is that not that the U.S. system, the structure is so wrong, which many people believe, especially on the left, but that the people in Washington are so corrupt and they've been there so long that they cannot rely on the Lindsey Grahams. They cannot rely on the Chris Christies or the Bushes. They have to bring in someone totally new. And that's what Trump is. Trump changed his party affiliation 5 times. He is something that the duopoly here can never account for, and that is the independent voter. That's really what Trump is. He's really an independent. He's not a Republican. Republicans repudiated him, the Republican elite, all the way up until May 2016, until the primaries, when the grassroots voted him in. So that's the big disparity here. And now, this message of corruption, this message that, the U.S. could be something, but not with the people currently in charge, who are controlled by big money, who are, only care about corporate America, who are globalists, who don't care about labor, who care about fighting, sending poor soldiers off to foreign wars. That's the appeal of Trump, and that's something that they're going to have to finally take seriously. They can't blame Putin for this one. I woke up a bit late today. Is it Russia's fault yet? These are the kinds of ideas that you hear all over the one medium that the right wing has in this country, and that's AM radio. If you're listening to the mainstream media, even really Fox News, Fox News will come out and say this Russophobia campaign is total nonsense. They will say that this impeachment campaign is a waste of our time. They will say that this white militia, which we have not seen all week, except for maybe these cops, we have not seen any white militia members, shooting up Main Street.
Thank you, Ramin. And Brian, we have a little bit of time left. I want to touch on that same thing as well. Why is it, like Ramin is saying, it's half an American, the U.S. population adores this guy. A lot of the other half, as well as most of the people outside the states, see him as an abomination of a leader, as really a joke of a man, a husband, a father, and even a businessman to that end. So my question to you, why is he so adored and loved by so many Americans?
Not everyone who supports Trump adores him. I think they just see him as a last-ditch effort against all the problems that your Chicago correspondent rightly outlined. I would just add in that there's the matter of a tide of secularism, a tide of central government running deep into the lives of everyone throughout the country, giving authoritative decisions on marriage and this and that, when perhaps they should just leave them up to the state. But yeah, Trumpism is going to be here. It just remains to be seen if Trump will be the leader of it in the next 4 years. My suspicion is he won't, but we're dealing with someone who's rather egotistical, to say the least.
But I want to thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Ramin Mazahiri joining us there out of Chicago, and Mr. Brian Downing there joining us from Florida. Thank you both. Stay safe. That's a little extended conversation we had with respect to U.S. media outlets announcing that Joe Biden has now won the U.S. presidential election, becoming president-elect now and future U.S. president, 46th in its history. We're following all these developments very closely here. Meanwhile, coronavirus pandemic surges throughout Europe, with several countries reporting new record highs in the number of infections and deaths. Italy registered over 40,000 cases in a single day, highest ever daily tally since the start of this thing. And the UK officials said that daily infections rose by almost 25,000. Austria posted a record high number of over 8,400 infections and 30 deaths. Death toll surpassed the 40,000 mark in France, where over 1.6 million infections have been reported. In Poland, the health ministry there announced a record of nearly 28,000 cases, bringing total infections to over 500,000. The Czech Republic confirmed 11,500 new cases, raising its total tally to over 403,000. Thousands of Pakistanis have held a new rally in the city of Karachi to protest against the French President Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam stance. The protesters denounced Macron's Islamophobic remarks and policies and called for a boycott of all French products. Demonstrations, the latest in a series of anti-Macron rallies in different Muslim countries. Last month, Macron outraged Muslims by defending the publication of insulting cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad under the pretext of the freedom of expression. This came after a teacher was beheaded by one of his students for showing the blasphemous caricatures. Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside his home to condemn his policies and once again call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. Demonstrations came despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over recent months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but denies any wrongdoing. The United States has blacklisted leader of Lebanon's biggest Christian bloc in our news political bloc. In our news review program, we discuss the latest developments in Lebanon. Here it is.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Lebanon's president has called on the U.S. to offer evidence and documents for imposing sanctions on prominent Christian politician Gebran Basil, who was also the president's son-in-law. Michel Aoun asked the country's caretaker foreign minister to obtain the data and submit it to Lebanon's judiciary to, quote, take the necessary legal measures. The U.S. has blacklisted the leader of Lebanon's biggest Christian political bloc over alleged corruption and ties to the Lebanese resistance movement. Washington deems Hezbollah a terrorist group, and Hezbollah has condemned the blacklisting as blatant and gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Basil says that U.S. sanctions will not intimidate him or force him to turning his back on the Lebanese people. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Beirut, Mariam Saleh. Thank you so much for being with us. Mariam, will fill us in on the latest and what's going on.
Well, we were expecting that there would be more people who were put on the blacklist, and maybe this is probably the final blow for Trump before maybe a possible defeat in the internal presidential election. But of course, when you look at this accusation, it seems that the Americans don't really have much on their plate. They don't have much evidence, and this is why we can even get from these statements of Hezbollah, who denounced, of course, they clearly denounced this this accusation, calling it political. And what they said is that the United States is using as a pretext its own internal laws and the laws that, in order to fight terrorism, to use them against the allies of the resistance, and under the pretext of fighting corruption. This is something that many are looking at as being ironic. You have people who were in power in Lebanon since the Civil War, since 1975 until today. They are still in power, and they are the ones who have been clearly corrupt. They have caused this corruption. They are, whether in the parliament or through being ministers or so on. Like, for example, the Falangist Party. You have some of the Druze parties as well. So many of those people who were in power are clearly responsible for the corruption that took place for over 30 years in the country, and still no sanctions have been forced on them. Sorts of measures have been taken against them. And now they come for Gebran Basil, who hasn't been in power more than a decade, and saying that he is accused of corruption. This is something that many are finding very ironic, and this is why President Michel Aoun is clearly wants to take legal measures. And we'll see how the foreign minister what he can get from the on legal issues, what type of documents he can get in order to perhaps respond to this issue. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hezbollah has considered this a clear violation of a country whom they say is not only a sponsor of the terrorism around the world, but also a sponsor of corruption and of corrupt states and dictatorship regimes as well. So Hezbollah was clear on this and that response. And of course, we're probably going to hear something which is official, but we are in the state of a caretaker cabinet. And this is why I think the president now is the only one who could probably take legal measures.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate being with me here on this news review out of Beirut. Mariam Saleh.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, scientists, doctors, and patients are beginning to unlock a puzzling phenomena. For many patients, including young ones, who never required hospitalization, COVID-19 has a devastating second act. Many are dealing with symptoms weeks or even months after they were expected to recover, often with puzzling new complications that can affect the entire body. Complications such as severe fatigue, cognitive issues and memory lapses, digestive problems, erratic heart rates, headaches, dizziness, fluctuating blood pressure, and even hair loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Wall Street Journal journalists Sarah Toy, Samathi Reddy, and Daniela Hernandez. The piece is titled, Doctors Begin to Crack COVID's Mysterious Long-Term Effects. Stay with us for more of Sarah Toy, Samathi Reddy, and Daniela Hernandez's article. Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, scientists, doctors, and patients are beginning to unlock a puzzling phenomena. For many patients, including young ones who never required hospitalization, COVID-19 has a devastating second act. Many are dealing with symptoms weeks or even months after they were expected to recover, often with puzzling new complications that can affect the entire body. Complications such as severe fatigue, cognitive issues and memory lapses, digestive problems, erratic heartbeat, headaches, dizziness, fluctuating blood pressure, and even hair loss. What is surprising to doctors is that many such cases involve people whose original cases weren't the most serious, undermining the assumption that patients with mild COVID-19 recover within 2 weeks. Doctors call the condition post-acute COVID or chronic COVID, and sufferers often refer to themselves as long haulers or long COVID patients. Usually, the patients with bad disease are most likely to have persistent symptoms, but COVID doesn't work like that, said Tricia Greenhalgh, professor of primary care at University of Oxford in England and the lead author of an August BMJ study that was among the first to define chronic COVID patients as those with symptoms lasting more than 12 weeks and spanning multiple organ systems. For many such patients, Greenhalgh says, the disease itself is not that bad, but symptoms like memory lapses and rapid heart rate sometimes persist for months. In October, the National Institutes of Health added a description of such cases to its COVID-19 treatment guidelines, saying doctors were reporting COVID-19-related long-term symptoms and disabilities in people with milder illness. You don't realize how lucky you are with your health until you don't have it, said Elizabeth Moore, a 43-year-old lawyer and mother of three in Valparaiso, Indiana. Pre-COVID-19, she was an avid skier and did workouts several times a week. Since falling ill in March, she has been struggling with symptoms including memory problems and gastrointestinal issues. She has lost nearly 30 pounds in weight. Estimates about the percentage of COVID-19 patients who experience long-haul symptoms range widely. A recent survey of more than 4,000 COVID-19 patients found that about 10% of those aged between 18 and 49 still struggled with symptoms 4 weeks after becoming sick. That 4.5% of all ages had symptoms for more than 8 weeks, and 2.3% had symptoms for more than 12 weeks. The study, which hasn't yet been peer-reviewed, was performed using an app created by the health science company Zoe in cooperation with King's College, University of London and Massachusetts General Hospital. Another preliminary study looking mostly at non-hospitalized COVID patients found that about 25% still had at least one symptom after 90 days. A European study found about one-third of 1,837 non-hospitalized patients reported being dependent on a caregiver about 3 months after symptoms started. With more than 46 million cases worldwide, even the lower estimates would translate into millions of people living with long-term, sometimes disabling conditions, increasing the urgency to study this patient population, researchers said. What they find could have implications for how clinicians define recovery and what therapies they prescribe, doctors said. Doctors say anxiety caused by social isolation and uncertainty surrounding the pandemic may exacerbate symptoms, though that isn't likely the primary cause. Other viral outbreaks, including the original SARS, MERS, Ebola, H1N1, and the Spanish flu, have been associated with long-term symptoms. Scientists reported that some patients experience fatigue, sleep problems, and joint and muscle pain long after their bodies clear the virus, according to a recent review chronicling the long-term effects of viral infections. What differentiates COVID-19 is the far-reaching nature of its effects. Whilst it starts in the lungs, it often affects many other parts of the body, including the heart, the kidneys, and the digestive and nervous systems, according to doctors. I haven't really seen any other illness that affects so many different organ systems in as many different ways as COVID does, said Zijian Chen, a medical doctor from Mount Sinai Health System Center for Post-COVID Care. He described colleagues who were energetic, but after getting sick, had trouble getting through the day. He said he has seen up close how COVID-19 still affects their ability to do the things that they love. We thought it was a virus that once it does what it does, you recover and you go back to normal, he said. Sometimes that isn't the case, and that is really scary, he said. A leading explanation for long COVID symptoms is that immune system activity and ensuing inflammation continue to affect organs or the nervous system even after the virus is gone, according to researchers. Some of the most compelling evidence for the inflammation theory comes from COVID-19 patients with signs of heart inflammation and injury months after the illness. One study looking at 100 COVID-19 patients 2 months after getting sick found that 78 had abnormal findings on cardiac magnetic resonance imaging, while 60 had cardiac magnetic resonance imaging indicating heart muscle inflammation. The study included hospitalized, non-hospitalized, and asymptomatic patients. Even those who had no symptoms at all and were young and fit, even in those patients we saw abnormalities, said Ike Nagel, one of the lead authors and director of the Institute for Experimental and Translational Cardiovascular Imaging at the University Hospital Frankfurt in Germany. Some patients had scarring on their heart imaging, he said, which worried him. The scarring wasn't too serious, he said, but we know from other studies that this is related to worse outcomes. Doctors also reporting cases of long COVID patients with gastrointestinal issues. Recent work has found the new coronavirus, known as SARS-CoV-2, in fecal matter and intestinal lining of some COVID-19 patients, suggesting the virus can infect and damage the cells of the gut. The intestines have a high density of ACE2 receptors, a type of protein on the surface of cells which SARS-CoV-2 uses to infiltrate cells.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. One of the most important topics in Islamic ethics is the topic of yaqeen or certainty. The difference between us and the infallible imams and generally infallibles is while we believe in something and we are not certain about it, they believe in something and they are certain. For example, about committing sins. While we know that when we commit sin, inevitably we go to hell, at the same time we commit sin, they believe in the same fact, but they know that committing sin is equal to going to the hell, and they see this fact as we see something by our eyes. So while we are not sure about something that we know, they aren't sure about the result of everything. As a result, they never commit sin as infallibles, but there is probability and possibility of committing sin by us. For the same reason, we have a famous narration from Imam Ali, peace be upon him. He says, لَوْ كُشِفَ الْغَطَاءَ مَزْدَتُ يَقِينَ. If the veils were to be uncovered, my conviction would not increase. When the veils that normally are in front of our eyes be uncovered, be removed. Because Imam Ali has reached the level of certainty, there is no difference between witnessing and saying with this type of veils or without this type of veils. And the last narration that I want to explain it a little bit is once again another narration which is narrated from Imam Ali, peace be upon him. بِالْيَقِينَ تُدْرَكُ الْغَايَةُ الْقُصْوَى. With conviction, the ultimate goal could be reached. The ultimate goal. What is the ultimate goal of the creation of human being? What is the ultimate goal? When we study our Islamic teachings, we realize that one of the most important goals of the creation of the human being is to be vicegerent of God. To be vicegerent of God on earth. This is one of the most important goals of the creation of human being. And to be vicegerent of God requires being similar to God. And this is exactly the meaning of perfection and completion. Probably you have heard, we want to be close to God. We want to be closer and closer to God. And finally, we want to reach God. What is the meaning of closer to God? What's the meaning of reaching God? The meaning is to fulfill those beautiful attributes of God in yourself more and more. And whenever you fulfill those attributes in yourself at the highest level, you have reached completion and perfection. You are now, you are more similar to God in comparison to anyone else. This is the meaning of perfection and completion.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
you would not be able to achieve this goal unless you achieve annihilation in God. You have to ignore yourself. Something that our prophets and our imams have fulfilled, have achieved in their lives. For the same reason, it's interesting to know, let me mention the name of the late Imam Khomeini. He was saying that the prophets of God do not have the attributes of sacrifice or altruism, al-ithar. They do not have such an attribute. It's interesting. It's a merit. It's a virtue. It's a good attribute. At the same time, they did not have it. Why? Imam Khomeini says because they, first of all, you have to know the meaning of sacrifice or isar. Isar is when you prefer someone else over yourself. This is the meaning of isar. Okay? But in the case of the prophets of God, because they did not see themselves, they were ignoring themselves in front of God, there was nothing to be witnessed in front of God as a result to prefer God over yourself. You are nothing. Everything is God. So Ithar would be meaningless. You do not prefer God over yourself. Rather, you do whatever you do for something that exists, which is God. You are nothing in front of God. So you are nothing in order to be preferred over God. This is the reason of that comment of the late Imam Khomeini. As a result, you have to reach the level of annihilation. You have to ignore yourself. And you would not be able to reach that level unless you reach the level of certainty. When you are certain about God, as a result, you are certain about the essence, attributes, and manifestations of God, you're going to achieve the ultimate goal of the creation. And the last point is, in our supplications, we ask God to give us that introductory measure in order to achieve this blessing of God. What is that introductory measure, which is considered to be a premise to achieve that goal? Is to be awakened by the love of God. You cannot reach the level of conviction unless you be awakened by the love of God. As a result, it's easy to pass the level of doubt and to reach the level of certainty. You want to commit sin, you would not have the power to avoid committing sin unless you love God. For your beloved, you avoid committing sin. You obey your beloved. Step by step, you're going to pass the position of doubt and to reach the level of certainty. Thank you very much for your time. time and attention. I ask Almighty God to give us this tawfiq to be awakened by Himself, His Messenger, and the successors of His Messenger, to have this tawfiq to gain the blessing of certainty. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Rahimallahu man qara'a al-Fatiha ma'a as-salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Farshid turab yadunni wa huwa ghita'i hawli ar-rimal taluffuni bal min wara'i wal lahd yahki فيها ابتلائي والنور خط كتابه أنسي لقائي أنسي لقائي والأهل أين حنانهم باعوا وفائي
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world that displaced 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. States shall therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that wars still cause the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources. While the high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold, and oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be twice as likely to relapse. Concerning this issue, we have prepared an article written by Farhanek Bakhtiari under the heading War Footprint Never Fades Away from Nature. Please stay with us for more of Farhanek Bakhtiari's article. When a war breaks out, one of the first things which comes to mind is casualties and destruction. Whilst one of the main victims of war is the environment, because the effects of war on nature never fade away and can be seen in the food cycle and nature for a long time. War always brings to mind the destruction of houses, deserted villages, smoky cities and streets littered with war weapons and barricades. Massive explosions and ultimately misery, homelessness and death. There are the obvious signs of war, but in the meantime, the part that has been out of sight and out of mind for years is the extent of damage it does to nature, the environment and everything in it, from animals to plants. Perhaps the catastrophe of human-caused war is so great that it is no longer possible to address, whilst the long-term effects of environmental degradation on the quality of human life are determined and manifested over time. Water wells have been polluted, crops torched, forests cut down, soils poisoned, and animals killed to gain military advantage. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world, and these displaced a total of 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on both people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. Countries should therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict, and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace, development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that wars still cause the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources, whether high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold or oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be twice as likely to relapse. The United Nations attaches great importance to ensuring that action on the environment is part of conflict prevention, peacekeeping and peace-building strategies, because there can be no durable peace if the natural resources that sustain livelihood and ecosystems are destroyed. In 2001, the United Nations General Assembly declared 6th of November of each year as International Day for Preventing the Exploitation of the Environment in War and Armed Conflict. Since the devastation of war knows no boundaries, all countries must work together to reduce the destructive effects of war, for example, during the Iraqi-imposed war in Iran in the 1980s, in the process of which Iraq dried up the Hur al-Azim wetland to limit the operation of Iranian fighters in defending their homeland, and now years after the end of that war, the sand and dust storms have taken over Iran, which originates from the dried-up parts of Hur al-Azim wetland in neighboring Iraq. or the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which is another example of this negative impact. During this war, hundreds of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire, polluting vast water and marine resources, as well as polluting the air. Oil and bitumen covered hundreds of kilometers of the coast of the Persian Gulf, which killed at least 30,000 seabirds. When Daesh terrorist group occupied a large part of Iraq and Syria, leaving the agricultural lands abandoned, caused the lands to become sand and dust storm hotspots. However, the negative impact of war are not limited to these measures and effects. Its physical effects still exist, as landmines planted during the Second World War some 70 years ago still claim lives today in Europe, or landmines planted by Iraqis in Western Iranian territories during the war also are taking the lives of hundreds of innocent Iranian civilians. Deputy Chief of the Department of the Environment, Masoud Tajrishi, told IRNA that one of the biggest challenges posed by conflict and war is population displacement. Putting aside the social impact of the war, the environment is the most important issue that has not received much attention. Tajrishi stated, during the 8 years of Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, we witnessed the displacement of large numbers of people in different parts of the country. He noted also, when the enemy entered Iran, invaded Iranian territory, it planted numerous mines, which made these lands unusable for a long time, even after the lands were taken back. People could not enter these lands because of fear of landmines, one of the major effects of which was sand and dust storms, as well as when Daesh terrorists controlled a large swathe of Iraqi and Syrian territory. Masoud Tajrishi regretted that also during the US-led invasion of Iraq and Kuwait, when a significant number of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire and smoke rose to miles in air, after studies shown that a significant amount of soot entered our land, settled on the soil, rain washed them into groundwater, fed on plants, animals and humans. He lamented statistics at the Basra Hospital 3 to 4 years after the American occupied Iraq showed that many Iraqi children were born with abnormalities, as well as serious complications and diseases for the residents of the Basra area, all of which were caused by chemical weapons, which the Americans used in huge amounts in Iraqi territory, harming both the Iraqi people and the environment. However, if we are to achieve sustainable development goals, we need to act with greater urgency and coherence to reduce the threats that armed conflict pose to our environment and ultimately pose to our health and livelihood.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.